But first, it's Wednesday and time for our weekly discussion of the latest in state politics with the Dakota Political Junkies. Joining this week is Denise Ross, editor of the Black Hills Knowledge Network and South Dakota Dashboard. And Denise, welcome to the program. Also with us on the line is Kevin Wooster, Rapid City reporter for KLO-TV. And Kevin, thanks for joining us this week as well.
Hey, Carl. It's good to be back, especially with Denise.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Kevin.
Good to have the two of you with us again. We can start off talking a little bit about the Senate Republicans. They'll likely meet within the next month to pick new leaders. That's according to Senate President Pro Tem Cory Brown. Senate Majority Leader Tim Rave and Assistant Majority Leader Dan Lederman resigned last week after the end of the 2015 session. Kevin, do you think Republicans will have any trouble finding some new leaders?
Well, they certainly have a lot of people to pick from. You know, I can't remember what the count is, 27, is it? And this means two have left to be replaced. So they're usually pretty good at transitions. And I'm not close enough to the process these days to know who the leading contenders would be. Maybe Denise has a better idea of that. But I would expect, I think Cory Brown said they hope to have a caucus meeting and elect some new leaders within a month or so. So I would expect that would go pretty well. There could be a contested spot there or two, but I wouldn't expect a big fight over it.
Denise Ross, do you expect any fight?
Well, and I'm going, again, I'm not close enough to the process anymore either to know who the leaders are, but the top contenders, but I would say that I would expect some kind of a jockeying for position amongst that large of a group. There's got to be some ambitious people in that group who want those jobs. And so I would look for a rather lively caucus meeting, although we don't get to really know what goes on in those meetings, but sometimes reports seep out here and there.
Now, go ahead, Kevin.
I just wonder, Denise, if you think, would you expect the conservative part of that caucus to rise up? And is that the kind of, or is it going to be people that are more traditionalist fighting for the spot?
So I would, judging by the Cracker Barrel that I go to in Rapid City, I would think that would be where the fight would be between the more conservatives and the more mainstream Republicans. Mm-hmm. But my sense is that we still out here in the West have more of those conservative voices, and the more establishment mainline Republicans still tend to win the day when it comes to taking votes in the Capitol. So I would look for a fight like that, and then I would look for the mainstream Republicans to win it, but you never know.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, do these party leadership positions sometimes lead to higher statewide office?
Well, there has been a few of them. When you look at Walter Dale Miller, for example, was one of the leaders for a long time and ended up through a tragedy becoming governor, you know, first lieutenant governor and then governor. And, you know, we've got a person, the Lieutenant Governor Matt Michaels, who is the president of the Senate, certainly is in that role, and they're... I don't recall anybody that has really gone on to huge things from those leadership positions. I think they're certainly important. And, you know, if you look at George Nicholson...
I want to make an important correction, though. Mike Rounds was a majority leader in the Senate before he was governor and before he was a U.S. senator.
Yeah, and George Nicholson, too, right?
Now, as I think
back, he was in a leadership role.
He was a speaker. And Matt Michaels was the Speaker of the House and had other leadership positions. So they definitely are a springboard, and I think it just depends on how ambitious the people are. I can't recall what leadership post Christy Milne held in the legislature, but I don't think she was a backbencher for her whole career in peer.
She a whip or an assistant, maybe? I mean, she was, one of the things about her was that she went pretty quickly. People were surprised how soon she came into that leadership spot. I'm not seeing anybody right here that I would expect to see a Rounds Nicholson thing, but I didn't think Mike Rounds was going to be governor either, so there you go.
Yeah, that was a surprise for a lot of people.
Yeah, you never know. And moving on from that, I guess, sort of a look back at history in South Dakota, one of the laws passed by the lawmakers last month was one raising the interstate speed limit to 80 miles per hour, and Rapid City Journal reporter Seth Tupper wrote about how House Majority Leader Brian Gosch pushed the speed limit into law as a part of the transportation funding bill without public testimony and public analysis on safety. And Denise, how did that all happen? Why wasn't there any testimony?
First, I want to just congratulate Seth on an excellent piece of reporting and just telling the story in a way that was so simple to understand, that you didn't have to be a political insider to understand what went on. So that was just a great piece of reporting by Seth, which is kind of his hallmark. He does really good work. But this is anyone, any reporter or lobbyist who's been with the legislature has seen this happen. You get towards the end of the session, there's a lot of bills that still haven't been dealt with, and amendments start rolling in, and it is easy under the process that we have here to get those amendments in. And in this particular case, Seth timed it, and it was something like 90 seconds of total discussion, and I wouldn't call it a debate. The amendment was introduced by Brian Gosch of Rapid City, who's in one of those leadership roles in the House and was chairman of that committee, and it was voted in. There was one sort of weak objection or question about whether this was the right way to handle this, but then it was included in that huge highway bill, which we're all familiar with, that raised the gas tax and will pay to fix a lot of our roads. And so that thing was such a juggernaut that this 80 mile per hour speed limit just sailed on through, you know, like a semi rolling down the interstate. There was no stopping it.
Yeah, rolling down at 80 miles per hour. Kevin, is this just the sort of thing that you know, when lawmakers, they're doing the work, this is the sort of thing that happens? I mean, is this reflective of the work that gets done in NPR?
Well, it's certainly not reflective of the way most issues are handled and most bills are passed, but it's pretty common late in the session for an issue to arise, and, you know, the standard round period is if you got two-thirds, you can do anything at any point, and that's pretty much true. And I've certainly been in on, you know, conference committee meetings standing in the hallway where people are gathered around outside with a few legislators putting some pretty important thing into legislation after all the process has gone through and the public testimonies has, you know, been done. And I've written columns about it. I imagine Denise has mentioned it. And that we have this process for public involvement, and at the end, these issues, sometimes pretty big issues, just get sort of rammed through without very much public opportunity. Now, you know, to say this was 90 seconds is a little bit deceiving in that the members of the committee had it days in advance. I assume the lobbyists involved in this were informed about it days in advance. Then it hits the committee floor. It's handled very quickly, you know, with very little discussion. And then there's time before the final vote on the floor for the interest groups that have been made aware of it to put their, you know, their opinions out and those kinds of things. But it's one of those things late in the season, late in the political season of the legislature, where an idea comes up or it's been held to come up, who knows, whether it's planned or spontaneous, and the public involvement is really, really subverted.
Denise, is it likely, or is there any way that the speed limit could then be lowered back to 75?
Well, you know, those Democrats are really good at gathering signatures on petitions. I don't know if they'll take this one on or not, but if we could see it on a ballot, that would be one way to lower the speed limit. You've already seen the Transportation Commission weigh in and say that they weren't happy with the process entirely and that they are interested in looking at what their role might be to moderate this at least. And we're already seeing that during the Sturgis motorcycle rally, they want to take it down between Rapid City and Sturgis. You know, over in Wyoming, which is, you know, even a little bit more Wild West than we are, they took 6 months to do a safety study. They took input from the Transportation Commission, and they have certain sections of roads where you can drive 80 and then others where you can't. And we just sort of did a blanket thing here in South Dakota. What I thought was most interesting was the Highway Patrol being very vocal, saying that if you go over 80, you will get pulled over. Don't think that 80 means 82, 83, 84, 85. It means 80. And so my husband and I and our two boys drove up to see a family in Aberdeen over the Easter holiday. And I said, really, this just means everybody's going to drive as fast as they always did, because when the speed limit was 75, a lot of people took it to 80 because there's a little bit of a forgiveness when you go a few miles over, it seems like. So I think you're seeing a little bit of pushback in some of those ways.
Kevin, have you been out on the interstate since it's been up to 80?
I have, and I think taking it to 80 is probably an error myself. I feel like 80 is a little fast, even on the interstate. But I'll tell you, when I went up to cover two fires in northwest South Dakota, when I was coming back to put my TV package together, when I hit the interstate, I set the cruise control on 80 and ran it all the way back to, you know, fill the Rapid City zone at 65. And so I was a hypocrite, but I was in a hurry, too.
Moving on to other stories, Republican Senator John Thune hasn't announced his reelection plans. He is expected to run for a third term. The big question still is, will the Democrats field a candidate? And Kevin, in your KLO blog, you write that you've been looking around, but you're not seeing any Democratic candidates. Will the party eventually find someone to run?
Oh, I hope so. The blog thread was more of a plea than anything else. Don't do what you did in the plea to the Democrats. Don't do what you did in 2010 and leave the place blank. I mean, so I wouldn't expect the big players, the big possibles, Brendan Johnson, Stephanie Hirsch, Sandlin, you know, folks like that, to step in right now, because unless John Thune does something crazy like going out in a shotgun and a bunch of long-eared bats or some other endangered species, I don't see him to be very vulnerable, and he's going to have, by U.S. Senate standards, a lot of money. Not a lot of money by presidential standards, but by presidential race standards, but $10 million or wherever he was the last time we looked. So I hope they come up with somebody, and I hope it's somebody that can challenge John Thune, because regardless of what you think of him, and he's very popular, people should be challenged for their Senate seats.
Well, do you see any Democrats in the state, anyone in the wings who could be a future political force, whether for the U.S. Senate race or another race?
Well, the only two that come to mind are the two that always come to mind, and that's Stephanie Hirsch, Sandlin, and Brendan Johnson. And I wouldn't look for them. This would be a pretty huge risk for them at this point in their careers, and I wouldn't expect them to take that risk on. But I agree with Kevin. I think as a whole, the Democratic Party needs to find somebody who can run a race to at least contrast against John Thune, who is, you know, among the most talented politicians in the entire country. He's just kind of got the whole package of knowing the policy, working hard, and being able to interact with constituents in a way that really connects with individual people. And so he'd be a very formidable candidate to run against, but I think they need to run somebody so that you can at least draw some contrast on certain issues where maybe the Democrats don't agree with John Thune, and try to at least have some kind of a race run.
Well, Kevin, the question continues, what will it take for Democrats to matter more in this state?
Well, it'll take some money. It'll take some issues. You know, that's been a key point in the past when they've had certain issues that they've been able to play off of, and they're doing that now. As I think Denise referred to on petition drives, they've had some success there lately with statewide white votes, which is about the only success they've been having. And it's going to take somebody with a charismatic personality, somebody like a John Thune with Democratic principles, somebody like a George McGovern. And we'll see. Brendan Johnson, good candidate. I thought Stephanie Hirsch of Salem, a good legislator and a very strong candidate. Will she come back? I don't know. Would she want to take on that kind of a difficult leadership role, which carries risks and affects your family life and everything? I don't know. I look at people like Billy Sutton. I think he's really a fine young state legislator, a senator down out of Burke, and people have high hopes for him, but they seem to be talking more in the terms of a governor's race someday. It's going to take people, it's going to take issues, and it's going to take money, and that's a lot to ask from that party right now.
Well, speaking of 2016 and John Thune, two Republicans have announced that they're running for president, Ted Cruz and Rand Paul. Marco Rubio expected to make an announcement on Monday. Denise Ross, is there any talk of John Thune as a candidate? Is he even interested in the job?
I don't know. I always have him in mind. And now are those three all only just Republicans? They're all Republican senators, just like Senator Thune. And I think that he could easily hold his own in the field that we're seeing emerge. Whether he wants to join that field or not is going to be entirely up to him. I think he has the fundraising potential because ever since he defeated Tom Daschle in 2004, he's been going around the country raising money for Republicans. So he's got that kind of a fundraising base, that kind of, I always refer to it as chips that these guys can call in when it's their turn to go for the brass ring. And I think I would expect him to do it. If not in 2016, I would expect him to do it at some point in the future because, as I said before, he's got the talent and the skill set, and I think he's got the ambition to do something like that.
Kevin Worcester, what do you think of the chances that he would run for president?
I think the concern on Jonathan's part is what it would do to his family and what it would do to the rest of his life and the risk involved. And I do think he loves being a U.S. Senator. He loves having time to come out here and hunt pheasants and be home on weekends and go to basketball games and all those kinds of things. And I think he is ambitious. I guess I haven't yet seen the kind of drive to be a national player in him that would make him willing to sacrifice all that you have to sacrifice to do that. Maybe it's coming, and maybe it's there, and he's just looking for the right spot. But he sure likes to come home and hunt pheasants and go to White River basketball games. So, we'll see.
Well, Kevin, you mentioned the northern long-eared bat. It's now listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service wants to protect the bats from further harm from white nose syndrome, a fungus that has decimated the population in some other states. Our senators, Senator Rounds and Senator Thune, are opposed to it, as the listing, as well as Representative Kristi Noem. Kevin, what is the controversy all about?
Well, listen, the long-eared bat is in trouble. The northern long-eared bat. I think there's some other types of eared bats that are down south, but that used to be a very plentiful bat, and the white-nosed syndrome has really devastated it in a lot of populations in a lot of areas. Not here. As far as we know, we don't have it in the Black Hills, and I think that's the argument by our delegation is they initially proposed it for the feds did for endangered listing, and it came back with a lesser listing. It's still important. It's threatened, and that's pretty much a done deal, as far as I understand it. The question is, what kind of rules will be in play, and how will that affect it? Right now, under an interim rule, I think the Black Hills is exempt, according to the folks that know more about this than I do in the logging industry here. And I think there are some benefits apparently from logging to this particular type of bat, which nests in areas of the forest and likes certain open areas, not clear-cut areas, but those kinds of things. So there, I think the logging industry and the delegation wants, at the very least, of forest management logging, for example, as it's done in the Black Hills, exempted from any effects by this designation. And, of course, they don't like a designation at all. I don't think you'll find any Republican congressional member from South Dakota that ever says, let's list a species as endangered or threatened. But I think what they're really concerned about are the rules and how they would affect the industry here.
Okay, well then...
I'm all about bats, baby. I know bats.
Well, that'll have to do it for the Dakota Political Junkies this week. Kevin, thanks for joining the program.
Great to be here. See you, Denise.
And Denise,
bye.
Denise, thanks for your time as well.
Thank you.